The Gary Noel Show, heard Monday through Friday at noon. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopez at Large coming up at 1 p.m. Just wanted to remind people that we're in the final days of this fund drive of winter 2020. So while the show is on the air, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 516-620-3602. Now stay tuned for the program.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. For decades, Michael Siegel grew Near North Insurance, a small Chicago insurance agency, into the fifth largest independent insurance brokerage in the United States. The $250 million firm had 950 employees in eight U.S. cities and operated an office in London until it was destroyed by a questionable federal prosecution. Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Maurice Posley details a story of how prosecutors crossed ethical lines, violated constitutional due process and FBI regulations in his latest book, Conviction at Any Cost, Prosecutorial Misconduct and the Pursuit of Michael Siegel. It's published by McDonough and Green and brings Maurice Posley and Michael Siegel to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Maurice, you write in your introduction that Michael reached out to you a number of times to ask you to write a book about what had landed him in prison, and you turned him down. What changed your mind?
I actually read some of the pleadings and read portions of the transcript, and the more that I read, the more I got intrigued that this was not a typical what you might say, you know, Chicago financial fraud case.
You're given sole writer's credit on the book's cover, but can we say that this is really a collaboration?
Yes, really. You have to, because without, I mean, first of all, there's a fair amount of Mike's opinion in the book, his view of things, because it's sort of, in a way, it's told from his point of view, although it's also grounded in the pleadings, the transcripts, the court documents, the public record. But it's hard to tell a story like this without having the person who's at the focal point, the center of it, involved.
Now, Michael, you were in a prison in Wisconsin when you began contacting Maurice. What had you been convicted for?
There's a variation of mail fraud called dishonest services, and I was convicted basically for alleged violation of Illinois insurance accounting regulatory statute. The net effect, it's a little complicated, but the net effect at the end of the day, the court records stated at sentencing there was no loss, no victims, no fraudulent intent, and no misrepresentation. Now, I'll leave it at that. I'll ask for further questions, but it's very complicated in the sense that I was originally sort of programmed in a sense that I had some trusted employees who went to a competitor after I turned them down of being able to take over my company. And that competitor had a relationship with a very new prosecutor in town called Patrick Fitzgerald, which people in New York should recognize his name.
Mm-hmm. So how long was your sentence?
10 years for victimless, no loss crime.
Less than Roger Stone.
Yeah.
Maurice, you note that there were 200 articles about the case published across all media, which you describe as including the most vicious types of mischaracterization and political taint. Did the prosecutors use the media to make their case?
I think there's no question that they used the media to exploit the case and to drive public opinion. One of the things that was particularly compelling was some of the circumstances of phone calls between that were documented by Michael's defense team that between members of these fellows who were trying to take over his company and basically were the ones that went to the FBI and triggered this whole thing.
You called them the takeover group with
right.
a capital T and a capital G.
Correct. And so the takeover group was had a lot of documented contacts with members of the media. There was one particularly interesting instance where a copy of a new superseding indictment was faxed to the takeover group, and it was clear that it had originated in the U.S. Attorney's Office. And this was before it had actually become, you know, before it was in the media. I mean, it was only a matter of a few hours, say, but it was clear that that people wanted to make sure that contacts were made with the media. A reporter actually called and said, "Hey, I've gotten a heads up from the U.S. Attorney's Office on a new round charging document, and they pointed out to me what's of interest to them that's new in this document." So, I mean, it's not unusual that prosecutors, either state and federal, they want the media to report what they do. It just seemed, based on the amount of phone call records in this case, that there was a lot more than what you might normally expect.
And, Michael, did anyone from the press approach you to give the other side of the story?
Unfortunately, forget about what I would say, but unfortunately, one of the key issues is after I refused to wear a wire for the government, we discovered a series of proven cyber crimes from my company taking attorney-client documents. And these were included in public filings at the court. And we actually exposed an FBI agent receiving one of the stolen documents. But it was always a puzzle to me that the media would never pick up the court filing itself, let alone what we had to say. So the answer was no, they never approached me, nor did they ever really follow what they would normally do in the procedures of reporting in this alleged crime.
Now, Maurice, you were with the Chicago Tribune. You want to defend your newspaper?
Well, no. you know, I actually was there when this was going on. I was doing other things, and so I didn't really focus on it. And it kind of... If it registered, as I described it before, as like, here comes another case, you know, that comes through the courts of some sort of financial fraud and didn't register. I will say this, that when I read the transcript of the trial and then went back and read some of the news coverage of the trial, I felt like there was a lot of information that was not either published or didn't seem to draw the attention. And by that, I mean people who were being cross-examined, and a lot of this case came in through the cross-examination, the cross-examination never showed up in articles. I covered the courts for a long time, and going back to even before I was at the Tribune, when I was at the Chicago Sun-Times, and this was in the 70s. And one of the things that I realized myself over the years was that I had become very prosecution-oriented in my reporting. And I think this still happens. Perhaps there's no real way to gauge it, but I think perhaps less so. But I had an instance where I was covering multiple trials at the same time, and I was go in and I would hear the direct examination in this one case, and then I would go off to the another case, another trial. And at the end of this particular case, the defendant was acquitted, and I realized I had no clue how I was going to write this story, because all I had heard was direct examination, the prosecution's evidence. I hadn't heard any of the cross-examination. And admittedly, reading a transcript is a flat document. You don't see the emotion that you see when you see someone on the witness stand. But I got a different feeling from the case by reading the transcript as opposed to reading the news accounts of the trial itself. And I will say this, that often defendants are not particularly, and Mike can speak to this, what reporters often will do is they'll call up the defense attorney, and the defense attorney will say, well, I'm not going to comment on this because it's a waiting trial, and I'll wait and I'll try my case in the courtroom. But I think Mike is definitely right about how no one really picked up at all on this, the fact that this former employee was stealing literally tens of thousands of emails and documents, many of them attorney-client privilege documents, many of them financial documents from the company, from Mike's company, and that they were winding up in the hands of the takeover group, and some of them wound up in the competitor that they went to work for, that was competing with Mike's company, as well as we know of, you know, one that went to the FBI, and that was one where they were forced to, first they said they didn't, and then they were forced to admit it when it was shown that they had received it.
And none of those people have been prosecuted?
No.
Not only prosecuted, but their apprehension was protected and interfered with. So in other words, the investigation was shut down by the FBI itself. And when there was local state's attorney's attempt to apprehend the cybercrime person, was interfered, a call was received from the U.S. Attorney's Office, this is our case. So, and this was a Fortune 500 company that had on its servers stolen emails that had trade secrets and proposals that we had out. So no one was prosecuted. Very disappointing. One of the things that I wanted to make clear through this is I'm not a conspiracy theorist. What happened here is totally, no, not even but. It's totally unusual here that we were able to document many of the things that went down here. And I think that's what convinced Reeves to take a look at this. And there's always two sides of the coin here. But this was really an unusual set. You talk about there were 67 phone calls to a main columnist in the Tribune before my arrest. And then the day of my arrest, every one of the media journals where my offices were had, before the U.S. Attorney's Office made a public announcement, had the fact of my arrest in the various different districts where my business was.
Now, this case has been described as a perfect storm because so many people crossed ethical lines in their pursuit of a conviction. And it's said to bolster their own ambitions. Maurice, is Michael's case unique in some ways because it includes so many people, a U.S. attorney, an FBI team, a prosecutor, a judge, and Michael's defense attorney? Or is the system often more corrupt than we would like to believe?
Well, I think that these things happen. But what's kind of makes this one unique is all the stuff that did happen, and none of it ever was ever acknowledged as being wrong. The judge rejected everything hand over fist.
Because the judge had his own agenda here.
Well, I mean, I'm not in his head. But, you know, the closest they came was at one point when the defense raised the issue. I mean, he wouldn't even give him a hearing on some of this stuff, let alone actually do something about it. But at one point, when the defense raised the issue that, you know, there were tens of thousands of attorney-client privilege documents had been taken in the search of the company's offices, and there was no taint team in place. And this is something that Department of Justice requires, that a disengaged from the investigation group review these documents to make sure that the investigations team, prosecutors and agents, don't see things they're not supposed to see that are covered by the privilege. And the judge actually granted the motion to give them back. And 3 weeks later, without saying a word why, he reversed himself on a motion to reconsider filed by the prosecution and said, no, never mind, you don't have to turn them over. But he never even gave him a hearing, a pretrial hearing, to explore in more detail some of these things. And, you know, what you have here is that they took the store. It's like thousands of boxes of stuff, computers, servers, everything. And so it's all sitting, you know, in the hands of the government. And the idea of what they're going to do with it, they won't say. You have to assume the worst. And the judge wouldn't even give them a day in court to explore some of the serious misconduct claims that they were making.
I'm talking on Leonard Lopate at Large today on WBAI New York with Maurice Posley, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's written Conviction at Any Cost, Prosecutorial Misconduct, and the Pursuit of Michael Siegel. And we are lucky enough to have Michael Siegel here as well. Maurice, haven't you investigated numerous cases of wrongful convictions and wrongful executions during your 25 years at the Chicago Tribune? And in 2009, you co-authored a report on prosecutorial misconduct in California. And I had always assumed that most of the wrongful convictions were of poor people, often from minority groups, not rich people like Michael Siegel.
One of the things that I do today is I'm a senior researcher at a three-university project called the National Registry of Exonerations. It's an online database of now nearly 2,600 wrongful convictions in the U.S. since 1989. And it's a small percentage, but there are a fair number of federal cases in there. Some of them are what you might expect that fits what you were talking about, drug crimes and the like. But there's some white-collar crimes in there, too. There's no exception, might say. Even the best money and the best defense in the world can't stop some of these things, because the way the system is set up, we rely very heavily on the integrity of prosecutors and agents to do the right thing. A lot of this is a hidden violation or crime, whatever you want to call it, when they fail to disclose evidence that's favorable to the defense. It's called exculpatory evidence. Unless you discover it, you don't know. And I mentioned this before, where at one point they said, no, we don't have any of these, and then when they got called on it, when there was some proof that arose that they did, they said, well, yeah, I guess we did have, like, one. They'll admit what they have to. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and indict all prosecutors, because I think
there are some good ones.
The majority of them do the right thing and don't particularly get credit for it. And, you know, it's sort of like you knew it was a hard job when you took it, and so do it right. Michael was viewed, I think, as someone who was to be bagged. That's why they confronted him and tried to get him to wear a wire. they felt that he was someone who could lead them to politicians, to business people, to people who were, you know,
trapped them. I'm sorry to interrupt.
To people who were prominent.
It entrapped them of what, Michael?
Of anything I was told. What I was told I must work to work with them to going forward, I said, what does that mean? They said, you wear a wire. I said, a wire with who? Anyone or any what we tell you to do, you know everybody in this town. So
and you refused.
Absolutely refused.
Now, you are not just a CPA. You're also a lawyer.
Yes.
So I would have thought that would have been an aid to you in during this whole process. It doesn't seem to have helped.
No, it's my mantra here is that I am not a conspiracy theorist. I don't believe the whole federal system is corrupt, but at times there's a total lack of check and balance at all the different levels, starting off at the prosecutor's office, managing directors, going to various levels of the court. And at times my book goes into very specific letters and documents filed with the Department of Justice. And there's basically a code of silence at times. I still believe in our system. I had a very unusual set of circumstances here. I don't want to go too into it. The prosecutor was fired once before and got his job back. And he continues on with the same style and the same methods of operation.
As we mentioned earlier, your troubles began when a group of former trusted top-level employees formed what you've called the takeover group and conspired to take control of your business. They accused you. Go ahead.
There's actual documents that we're able to pull off our computers. They labeled it takeover document. They would get $50 million, and they would sell one of my companies, and I get the balance. And it's just unfortunate. But where we perfect storm came about, they ingratiated themselves with a major competitor.
You don't want to mention the name? Because you do. Sure. It is revealed in the book.
It's in the book, Aon Corporation.
And it's a Fortune 500.
Company. Yeah, Fortune 500. And they also they had a political background. And they were able to get an introduction to, in my belief, to the new incoming U.S. Attorney, Patrick Fitzgerald. 3 days after Fitzgerald took office, my investigation started.
So if you had cooperated, do you think that none of this would have happened? I'm sure you've thought about that in the past.
Oh, yeah. Well, the big thing is I made a mistake by fighting them and going after the constitutional issues that my attorneys artfully raised, breach of attorney-client privilege, incomplete and inaccurate evidence that's not corrected. There's a whole host of things. Taping my defense attorney. I made a mistake by doing that because basically I'm a practical guy. I'm not naive. I really feel under the circumstances of what I was involved with, there was no way of winning. And also, you know, 97% of the cases in this particular area are successful by the government. It's just too hard.
Now, they accuse you of fraud. Of what? They said that you had stolen $30 million to do what?
No, the newspaper said that. Oh. And all I could say is I'm not being defensive, but my court records and the book shows it, says that there was no loss. No victims. There was no fraudulent intent. That's important to understand that. I didn't say that. The court record said that. And there was no misrepresentation or nondisclosure. And there was no loss. So the point of the matter is I was being punished for fighting the government. And they were successful.
And jump in. Mauricio, you began the book with a meeting in early 2002 at the Westin Hotel in Chicago. Michael went at the request of a former employee, Tim Gallagher, to have coffee. And it was just 6 days after Michael had filed a lawsuit against Gallagher and the takeover group?
correct.
What happened?
And, well, this was this things escalated rather rapidly. Instead of as he saw Gallagher in the hotel lobby and walked toward him, and he thought that perhaps Gallagher was having second thoughts about this takeover attempt and perhaps wanted to have a meeting and maybe reconcile their differences. And instead he raised his
he gave him the finger.
Flipped him the bird as two FBI agents came up and took Mike by the elbows and said, we're going to go upstairs and have a little chat. And this is a tactic that has been used for years now.
It was a trap.
Well, it's basically, it's similar to, you know, show up at people's doorstep at 9 o'clock at night and say, we've got you, we've got the goods on you, cooperate now, this is your own, one and only chance, or we're going to bring down the thunder on you. And that's essentially what was done here. And they said, that's when they said, you're going to have to take a felony, and you're going to have to work with us.
And wear the wire.
And when he said, what's that mean? And they said, wear a wire. And when he said, oh, on who? And they said, anybody we tell you to. And so, and that's what happens to people. That is a tactic that has been used successfully by the government to make cases.
Well, Mike, you were about to land a lucrative deal with the Sony Corporation, so I suspect you were in very good spirits at the time.
Yeah.
And when you refused, they told you that they had the authority to put you under arrest. On what grounds?
Yep. Well, misleading, and that was the point. And I should have known better, but I'm a salesman by heart. And I first said, I don't want to go with you. You'll have to get my lawyer. But then I anticipated that this related to this, what I believe was incomplete and inaccurate, allegations of the insurance state regulation, insurance regulation. So I decided, well, I'll explain to them. I thought everything was on the square because I'm a practical street guy. So they had no authority to arrest me, but they said they did.
And then they brought a prosecutor in the U.S. District, the U.S. Attorney's Chicago office, Dean Palalis. And
yes,
he pulled out files that had been taken from your office? Isn't that illegal?
Yes, certainly.
What happened, man?
And they were obviously, in my opinion, we were taken by the takeover group. And this prosecutor was very unusual. You don't visit someone. The FBI usually does an investigation. Very rarely does a prosecutor attend these situations. And so they had me sit there when I said, I don't think I'm going to be in a position to do this. They said, sit here. And I didn't realize at that time, this is sort of a little color into this thing and dramatic. So they put me in an adjoining room, and I really didn't know what was going on. And really, I didn't have my senses with me. I'm on my way to celebrate something, to go to Europe with my wife for our business. And I'm sitting in a room. And what they were doing is they were getting a hold of the takeover group to sign the necessary documents for an arrest. So within 45 minutes, they had the documents, and they went to a magistrate judge. Then they came back in, and they gave me one more chance to wear a wire, and I said no again. And there was two big curtains in the room, and I was curious why there's two big curtains. Outside, the curtains opened, and two FBI guys stood up and said, you're under arrest now. And they took me downtown.
Wow.
They kept me there to 3 o'clock. So I wouldn't be able to call my lawyer.
Didn't they even cite an invented precedent for all of this?
No.
Oh.
It's very unusual. The federal government doesn't really arrest people less in the process of a crime. One usually goes before the grand jury. And then they call the lawyer, bring your guy in. I had a lawyer tell me that he had substantial dope dealers, okay, that they would call up and say, bring him in next Wednesday, he's indicted.
This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, listener-sponsored radio at 99.5 FM.
took him in the lineup and let those bright lights shine. There was 10 poor souls like me in that line. I knew he was a victim of someone's evil plan.
My guests today are Maurice Posley, author of Conviction at Any Cost, Prosecutorial Misconduct and the Pursuit of Michael Siegel, and also the subject of his book, Michael Siegel. And gentlemen, we'll get to you in just a moment. I'm sorry we have to take a little break. Today is the last day that we can do fundraising on our show during our winter fund drive here at WBAI. So we want to just take a few minutes to tell our audience what we hope they're going to do. And joining me now is Jesse Lent, my executive producer. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, Leonard. It's great to be here. Yes, this is it, everyone. This is the final day.
For us, anyway.
For this show.
Well, it's a short month.
Exactly. This is the end of, or should I say, the final Leonard Lopate at Large that will air during this drive. So if you are the kind of person who puts things off to the last minute has arrived, or at least will arrive in about 23 minutes. And we really hope that you will step up and show your support by going to our website, give to WBAI.org. That's give, then the number 2, WBAI.org, or call our pledge line at 516-620-3602. This is the honor system, Leonard. We have no way of insisting that only people who support the station can listen, nor would we want to, because we know that everyone's financial situation is different. But as we've said in the past, if you are able to make that contribution in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large, please consider doing so right now.
And keep in mind that we don't take ads on the station. We don't get foundation grants or grants from anybody. We rely solely on the support of our listeners, the people who we hope appreciate the kind of programming that WBAI provides. And we'd also like to believe, like what we do here at Leonard Lopate at Large. So please give us that call, 516-620-3602, or go to our website, give to WBAI.org. That's given, then the number 2, WBAI.org. And Jesse, we have an incentive to people who become BAI buddies, sustaining members of the station.
That's right. You know, every contribution that we get for the station, especially in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large, goes a long way, not just to allowing us to continue to bring you this show, but also letting station management and network management understand that this is a priority show. Right now, if one way you can show your support is by becoming a BAI buddy. Now, that's a sustaining member of the station, a monthly contribution of $10 or any amount, really, that will allow us to plan for the future and continue to know that our support for the show will be here.
I should point out that $10 a month comes to $120 a year. We're talking about a reasonable amount in small drips and drabs. You could do $15 a month or whatever you're comfortable with. But we are not asking you to go bankrupt to support the station.
Hey.
We're asking you to do something that we think is quite reasonable. And we hope that as a lot of you will do it. And we're offering some a little gift as a thank you.
This is true. So just for today, as our final bonanza at the end of the drive, we're offering any of the books that we've been discussing for this drive if you become a BAI buddy in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. G. Wayne Miller on his book Kid Number One, Alan Hassenfeld and Hasbro, Robert Crease's 10 Great Thinkers Throughout History, Jeff Madrick's Invisible Americans, The Tragic Cost of Child Poverty, Michael Patrick McDonald's All Souls. Any of the books that we've been discussing, just when you call or make that contribution online, put in the comments section which book it is you want, and we will make sure you get it. If you need a refresher on some of the books, you can go to wherever you get your podcast for this show, or you one place for that, soundcloud.com/LeonardLopate. And that's Leonard-Lopate, to be specific. We'll show you all the different shows we've had. But this is really just a way of saying thank you, not just to our listeners, but to all the guests who have partnered with the show this month and allowed us to offer their work for a contribution.
So, again, the number 516-620-3602 or online, give2wbai.org. And we hope that you'll consider becoming a BAI buddy, a sustaining member. But if you prefer not to, but still want to help us out, any amount is purely welcome. We really appreciate any show of support that you give us. You want to give us $10, $15? Somebody just stopped by our office this morning and said, hey, I gave $100 yesterday. Well, thank you so much, all of you who have come through. And if you haven't, please help us continue doing this kind of show that we do, these one-hour in-depth interviews on subjects that don't get as much attention as they should. If you want to hear about what's going on in the news, well, you can turn on a whole bunch of stations. You'll hear the same breaking news stories again and again. I'm not saying that you shouldn't, we shouldn't be paying attention to those stories. They're really very important. But there's a lot of more things going on in the world, and we hope that we are helping you learn about those things.
I mean, the bottom line is you couldn't do a show like this in commercial radio, right? I mean, you and I both have, most of our listeners, I'm sure, have listened to other stations. I wouldn't expect them to be that chase to only listen to WBAI, although I have met some people who tell me it's the only station they listen to. But look, there's going to be traffic. There's going to be weather. Even at another NPR station, there's the certain amount of bumpers and promos and things that you need to keep the show moving along, I believe, is the standard reason given. You know, to be able to produce a show uninterrupted like this for the full hour, without exception, full stop, is really unique, not just on the New York radio landscape, but I would venture all across this country. But we can't do it without your support. You know, Leonard, you mentioned before that a BAI buddy, you know, $10 a month, that's a pretty convenient way to offer a donation if you're able to do that. BAI buddies, it's also one of those win-win situations, right? Because for the station, it allows us to plan and do all the things we've been talking about. So, one last time.
And you can stop it at any time that you wish.
Exactly. There's no contracts. There's no penalties. Like we've been saying all along, this is the honor system. There's no trick here. We're just trying to keep this crazy experiment in community radio on the air. You know, I often talk about this with guests on the show about how Pacifica actually predates NPR, and our funding model, a version of it went over to National Public Radio, but this is really the original, the OG version of public radio, in the sense that really there are no side deals. There are no corporate underwriters coming in to save us if we're not meeting our goals. All it is us with our microphones asking you to step up and allow us to keep bringing you this show. So if you listen, we ask this last time of this drive to please go to give2wbai.org or call 516-620-3602. Thank you to everyone who's contributed during this drive, and also to everyone who's listened to a lot of fundraising. This is our only choice, and we know that it sometimes gets tedious.
And we won't be bothering you again for a while.
You get a few weeks off, everybody. I would love to say that it was going to be the last fund drive, but if we get enough BAI buddies, the goal is that if we can eliminate these drives, at least we can seriously reduce them. Right now, Leonard Lopate is one of the shows with the most buddies on BAI, and though we're not competitive, we would love to be number one, and we're just about six buddies off for making that happen. So if you can step up today, we'd really appreciate it.
And thank you so much, Jesse. Let's get back to my guests. Maurice Posley, author of Conviction at Any Cost, Prosecutorial Misconduct and the Pursuit of Michael Siegel, published by McDonough and Green, and Michael Siegel himself. Maurice, we don't have time to get into everything that happened in this case, but this whole thing sounds a bit Kafkaesque, like the plot of a Scott Turow or John Grisham novel about stolen files, corporate espionage, cyber crimes, unlawful surveillance, and wild prosecutorial conduct. What were some of the bizarre and Byzantine crimes that Michael was accused of?
Well, I mean, when you come right down to it, the what he was accused of doing...
You said it was a victimless crime.
Well, the way that the insurance worked here, his company is a brokerage, and so I own ABC Construction Company, and I want to bid on a contract to build public housing in the city of Chicago, and I have to have proof of insurance before I can qualify as a bidder. So I go to Mike's firm, and I say, this is the nature of what I'm bidding on, and I'm looking for an insurance policy that will cover me and satisfy the requirements of the city of Chicago. And so he goes to companies and solicits bids for insurance companies and solicits bids to provide this insurance. And so ultimately an entity is selected that's going to be the insurer. And so the insurer says, well, ABC, here's what your premium is. And so the premium that's paid by my construction company goes to Mike Siegel's company, and it's put in what's called a premium fund trust account. And he takes his commission, and then the remainder of the money goes to the company that provides the insurance. Not an unusual transaction in the sense that anytime there's a business that provides a service that takes a cut for providing the service, and in this case, every insurance company got their premium. Every insurance customer got their insurance. So this fund, which was the subject of this case, it was said that he had taken $30 million out of it.
And done what
well,
with it?
Pardon?
And done what with the $30 million? Just put it in his pocket?
Well, that's essentially what they argued. They didn't have to argue that he did anything particular with it. They could just say that he, you know, didn't keep, that he took the money, whatever he did with it. And the fact is that it's hard to imagine that if everybody got their insurance and every insurance company got their premium, how this money would have disappeared. And that's, you know, one of the things that I call sleight of hand that was basically used to suggest that, and it's like, where is this money? And the jury bought it. And away he went.
Well,
and not only that, they took his company. Hmm. And 1,000 people lost their jobs. They dismantled the company. And it just sort of defies common sense and logic to me. And when you read the transcript and see the basis for what they were making their claims, none of it was based on generally accepted accounting principles. Common acronym is GAAP. It was based on sort of manipulation of some bank statements, and I mean, I don't want to go too far down the road on this, but the fact is that nobody lost any money. I don't get it. And so they made the argument that he had deprived he had deprived people of his honest services through this. I'm almost wordless, even though I've spent 5 years, you know, dealing with this. It almost leaves me speechless.
Michael, why were your attempts to expose pretrial constitutional motions in regard to cyber crimes and unlawful search and seizures unsuccessful? Don't we live in a system of checks and balances?
I want to be very careful how I articulate this. A very unusual landscape. The judge was a prior U.S. prosecutor, and he worked in the same office as very close to the three prosecutors that were involved in my case. And at times, these people just have to take a position to protect their prior association, and they call it, they have to protect the reputation of the office, no matter what their friends or U.S. attorneys do. In this case, it was particularly outrageous because we have a media that really took interest in my case and took interest in very lively interest. So the judge also had a good opportunity to, get in the papers, more so than the average judge would like to be in. Other people have a theory. So it was just, we were just basically shot down. And my lawyer on the pre-constitutional motions was an ex-U.S. prosecutor who had enough gumption, enough to push aside his prior relationship of employment, and he did most articulate basic, and he wouldn't put anything that was frivolous and screaming or anything like that. And it was just terribly disappointing.
Hadn't his office been bugged? Hadn't he been bugged?
One of my attorneys, not his office, but another attorney was bugged. And they didn't want to turn over the tape recordings. And when they did, they were, in my opinion, they were deliberately mixed up. But
so, now this sounds like
a
local
culture there.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
There's a whole culture there of prosecutors that move in to be judges. And there's a lot of interest in self-aggrandizement of various people involved. Not all the time. There's some wonderful prosecutors and wonderful judges. I almost received a perfect storm for a lot of the issues. In this particular judge, there's something called pretrial motions. So when we really went to trial, the government said that we should not be allowed to talk about the misconduct, cyber crimes. We should not be allowed that my company was destroyed by this RICO, and the judge said, fine. So we weren't even allowed to even talk about those issues at our trial.
Key witnesses changed their testimony after they'd been contacted by the FBI. Why? This sounds like a local case. Why is it the United States versus Siegel?
Well, it's a federal charge. Mm-hmm. All federal cases say that. If it's a state case in Cook County, it's Cook County versus Joe Doe. So
Leonard,
all federal prosecutors.
I was going to say, right, Leonard, you put your finger on something more shocking, and it's sort of clouded up. Is the federal government by specific law called the McCarran-Ferguson statute? It goes back several decades. Says that the federal government shall preclude its regulation of insurance. And that's why every state has its own insurance department, its own insurance regulations. And my lawyers, it sort of missed it at the middle or at the end. It's a belief that the federal government had no jurisdiction to get involved with state insurance. And that was also very discerning. So my book has a lot of interest in the insurance people out there. They still scratch their heads over these decades of how the federal government manipulated some type of federal crime.
How long were you in prison, and what led to your release?
I was in prison for 8 years, eight years. I was in a maximum prison, semi-maximum, till the judge had time to rule on my sentencing for 17 months, and that was quite of an experience. I'm proud to say that I can get along with all types of people. I had no bad experiences. And that particular prison was, I was put in there with no, because they said I wasn't entitled to any bail. I was a flight risk, but they took my passport and took all my money. So I don't think I was going to be a flight risk. And it was very difficult, and it was purely an act of vindictiveness. And I have to say, I was disappointed in the judge for going along with the request not to give me any bail. And that took away all my ability to deal with my financial records, to get positioned for my forfeiture hearing. It was very, very sad, but I've still got a lot of energy, and I'm still have my head up high. And
are you back in the insurance business?
No, I'm involved in a title business, and I'm involved in, curiously enough, I'm still involved in litigation of trying to get some of my forfeiture money, which I believe was unjustly taken by the same prosecutor.
And you didn't tell me why, what led to your release.
Oh, yes. My release, so I was a little bit early, and that's another issue that was sort of interesting. And that in 2010, the Supreme Court said what I was technically charged with, what's called dishonest services, is unconstitutional, and it only apply to conduct pursued by the federal government that relates to someone who was involved with a bribe or a kickback. And none of those facts, and everyone agreed, had nothing to do with me. So at 2010, I was in prison for an unconstitutional crime. Well, it took a little time for my lawyers to go back to the court. And finally, we went back to the appellate court. And the prosecutor said, well, he really didn't mean dishonest services. It really was regular mail fraud. And one thing led to another, and the judge took close to 9 months. Then he finally said he would release me.
Now, you must have been concerned about how you'd be received by everyone after your reputation had been smeared by the case and all the negative media coverage, articles that claimed that you were a thief who had stolen $30 million. But you say that people welcomed you back. They recognized that an injustice had occurred here?
Absolutely, and which I'm very thankful for, fortunate for. People come up to me occasionally on the street, and they hug me. Some people don't even know me, and they say, we don't understand what happened. Some people think that, okay, whatever you did doesn't deserve what happened to you, and I say I'm thankful. I get tearful, and I say, read my book when it comes out. I'll help you get a better explanation.
Maurice, can reforms be put in place that might prevent something like this from happening in the future?
Well, part of the problem with prosecutorial misconduct in general is that if the first gatekeeper, the prosecutors themselves, are unethical, it's difficult to stop. Then we have to, the next step is relying upon the court. And if the court matadors it through, as what happened here, the gatekeeper of the second instance is the judge. And then the appellate courts put their stamp of approval on it. And then, as Mike took it even further and had some incredible packages put together to send to the Justice Department Office of Professional Responsibility, which is supposed to investigate this sort of thing. And the answer was, we don't even know if they even looked at it because
I have to leave it there. I'm sorry, I've run out of time.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity.
My great thanks to both of you, Michael Siegel and Maurice Posley, author of Conviction at Any Cost, Prosecutorial Misconduct in the Pursuit of Michael Siegel, published by McDonough and Green. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Special thanks to our live engineer, Reggie Johnson, and to our executive producer, Jesse Lent, for their invaluable contributions throughout the week. If you're new to our show and you like what you've been hearing, you can access past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're also available as an iTunes podcast. And don't forget to check out Leonard Lopate at Large on Facebook and Twitter. Also our website, LeonardLopateAtLarge.com, where you can find links to all of our past shows. We hope you'll join us on Monday when Jeremy Salt will discuss his book, The Last Ottoman Wars, The Human Cost 1877 to 1923. Still a troubled area. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you on Monday. And for the last time during this winter fund drive, and from us anyway, if you haven't stepped up to support Leonard Lopate at Large and the station that brings it to you every weekday, please consider becoming a member of WBAI. You can do that by, we'd like you to become a BAI buddy, or go to WBAI, well, give to WBAI.org. That's given the number 2, WBAI, or give us a call at 516-620-3602. And thank you if you do, and thank you for listening under any circumstances.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Chris Bengert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. More than a dozen countries have recorded their first confirmed cases of the coronavirus over the past 2 days. That list includes Nigeria. This Nigerian case is the first in sub-Saharan Africa. And the World Health Organization has previously warned that a mass outbreak across Africa could pose a serious threat due to, quote, fragile health systems across the continent. The California patient who tested positive for the coronavirus after being hospitalized is in serious condition and is intubated. Her case could be the first U.S. instance of community spreading, which means the virus is circulating among the local community and infecting people, including some who are not sure how or where they became infected. Fears that a coronavirus pandemic could tip the world economy into recession sent global stocks into a tailspin today, with markets on track for their worst week since the financial crisis that began in 2008. European indices fell sharply, led by losses in the travel and resources sector, continuing the slump in Asia earlier in the day. The Dow Jones dropped 1,000 points so far, while the S&P and NASDAQ composites are both down about 2%, and the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield also hit a record low this morning. A Health and Human Services official is seeking whistleblower protection after reporting that the department sent workers to receive Americans evacuated from Wuhan without proper training or protective gear. The workers were not tested for the virus after being exposed to the evacuees, and the official alleges she was improperly reassigned after raising alarms. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration announced it's been alerted to the first manufacturing shortage of an unnamed drug due to the economic impacts of quarantines and other related responses to the coronavirus outbreak. IFDA Commissioner Stefan Hahn said the agency has been closely monitoring the medical product supply chain with the expectation that the outbreak of the virus would likely have an impact. White House Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney today downplayed the threat of the virus, but acknowledged likely school closures and disruptions to public transportation in the U.S. as a result of the outbreak. He also accused the press of peddling a false narrative about the administration, quote, scrambling to contain the virus, saying he had briefed Congress 6 weeks ago. Yet the White House is muzzling the administration's own public health officials, directing them to clear any comments with the Office of Vice President Mike Pence, who Trump has tapped to coordinate the federal coronavirus response. The New York Times reports that, quote, Dr. Anthony Fauci, one of the country's leading experts on viruses and the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, told associates that the White House had instructed him to not say anything else without clearance, end quote. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo appeared today before a committee of Congress probing whether the Trump administration had adequate justification for the assassination of top Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani in Iraq earlier this year. The hearing was almost immediately testy as Democrats, who hammered Pompeo for not appearing until almost 2 months after the Soleimani strike, instead used their questions to ask about, of course, the coronavirus. Pompeo told the committee that the U.S. has offered to help Iran with its coronavirus outbreak. He pushed back on the idea that U.S. sanctions are hampering the ability to send medical supplies to Iran, despite reports that the sanctions hurt Iranians' access to medical equipment. Iran has reported the highest number of deaths from the coronavirus outside of China. More than 200 people in Iran, including the deputy health minister and a vice president, have tested positive for the virus. Of the confirmed 245 cases, 26 people have died. Weather in Washington, D.C. today is mostly cloudy, highs in the 40s. Tonight, mainly clear, lows down into the 30s. And tomorrow, partly cloudy, highs back into the 40s. In Washington, D.C., it's currently 46 degrees and cloudy. And in New York, 40 degrees and mostly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.